And so the time has finally come. The bourgeoisie of sad wars agree with proletarian blood.
And that blood which flows from their pen
is the closest that they've ever been to the people.
You've been to our shows.
Yes, sung your songs.
Now we're asking you to add to each chorus you've sung and
protest against injustice, state terror on the streets of the world for the disempowered. You sung at our shows, cheered right over wrong. Now it's time to hit the streets, back up those words you've sung.
Because our voices alone this time will not get it done. Looking to stop a rogue regime.
Well, the first one that we must confront is Washington, D.C.
The Bush chair war, unconstitutional, unconscionable.
We refuse to let them kill with our name for royal.
We know the game.
All that corrupts.
It's up to us to hit the streets. Time to take our rights back. Yeah!
Protest against injustice, state terror on the streets of the world for the disempowered. You sung at our shows, cheered right over wrong. Now it's time to hit the streets, back up those words you've sung.
Because our voices alone this time will not get it done. Because the people united will get it done.
Protest against injustice, state terror on the streets of the world for the disempowered.
One, two, one, two, three, yeah!
Protest against injustice, state terror on the streets of the world for the disempowered. Protest against injustice, state terror on the streets of the world for the disempowered. Protest against injustice, state
terror. Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just catching up with us, we're listening to Straight Talk about the next American Revolution with Gar Opperbitz.
Virtually all of this also has an ecological flavor. It's very, all the projects I've been, not all, but most of them are green. And also connected with this is kind of an agricultural movement. Urban agriculture, but also CSA, agricultural from farms that sell to cities and sell to groups in cities. There's a whole food movement part of this. There's another piece of it that is takes on various forms. A social enterprise, I don't know if that's a term you know. What's a social enterprise? There are thousands of these popping up. Anyway, I'm just reporting the news at the moment, what's going on. But a social enterprise is somebody sets up a business to make money, the only purpose of which is to provide for a social service. That's what the business is about. So a traditional one. There's some old ones, and then there's thousands of new ones. Pioneer Human Services in Seattle, you probably don't know about it. It was set up to do drug rehabilitation with very seriously ill people. And they started 35 years ago, it was mostly grants. Get grants to help people with a drug problem. And slowly they realized that if they're going to get anywhere, these people had to have jobs and job training. So they start building little stores, restaurants, hotels, factories, in order to give these people a job training route. And so that, because then the therapy works, there's a future. Then they realized they could make enough money out of the businesses that were owned socially to begin financing their drug rehab programs. You get the model? Begin to transform the ownership. And that's an old one. It's been there 50 years and it stands there. Those things are popping up all over the country too. Another way to transform the ownership of wealth, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. One of the reasons I'm giving you this kind of detail, and I'll give you a website to change, and a lot of it's in the book, you know, What Then Must We Do, is because it's being done here and can be done anywhere in the country. When people begin to realize they're doing it over there, we could do it here. It's not that hard. So So people are beginning to kind of get information nets. Here's a website, community-wealth. Put the dash in because there's one without the dash. And this simply surveys this stuff. And kind of, if it's not there, it can lead you to another website. It's got more detail on worker-owned companies, another one on land trust, et cetera. And the way I think about this as a historian, this process, and why it may have larger implications, is that it is beginning to train and lay down foundations over time, which are building up knowledge and people and awareness. And if the conditions continue, that process is likely to go on. So if you looked at the New Deal, when the New Deal took place, what did it build on? It built on the things that were happening locally in the so-called state and local laboratories of the nation, like Wisconsin, where people were working out things that became Social Security. They were working out the principles at the state level. Labor law principles were developed state and local level. And when the moment was right, enough experience was available to move that to the national level. I think that analogy is very important. Or I'll give you another analogy and why these experiments, they're more than experiments, take on a different kind of feel when you say, what then must we do? Because you can do this. If they can do this in Cleveland, and I'm going to come to Cleveland or real poor cities, it can be done by anybody who wants to do it. Another analogy. In the 19th century, the prehistory of the populist and progressive era looked exactly the same. Lots of things at the local level that began building a politics and began extending to the national level as time went on. Our third analogy, the feminist movement in the 19th century. Look to the women. Year by decade by decade by decade, at state by state by state by state for 50 years until they had enough power, then moved it nationally and took over the national constitutional debate. So I pay, as a historian, I pay attention to this kind of thing, particularly when there are signs that it's likely to continue because the pain levels continue and there are no answers. So that's one level. I'm not going to go into so much detail into other processes at work. They all have this characteristic, changing the ownership of wealth and doing it in a way that democratizes it but doesn't statize it. Very American way of changing and transforming ownership. This is not Soviet Union or East Europe. It's down home. I'm from Racine, Wisconsin. That's the kind of thing we find in Racine, and you certainly find it in Madison. And it is much more important, in my view, and it is spreading than most people think. So here's a couple other areas. At the state level, too. This is mostly grassroots, neighborhood level. I mentioned one city level, that is public ownership of utilities. That's getting to the city level. At the state level, something else is happening. And here's another development. You all know about the Bank of North Dakota? Bank of North Dakota has been there for 90 years in the state of North Dakota. It is a socialized bank. The state owns the bank. It is supported by, that's a very conservative state. It is highly supported by small business, farmers, cooperatives, etc., because it's a functioning public bank. 20 states have introduced legislation to set up a bank like the Bank of North Dakota. If I'm not mistaken, you still have a very small public insurance company in this state. It's been hedged in, but there it sits from the progressive era and could be expanded upon. So, but banking at the state level and in the city level. Every city has money from tax money. Where do they put it? They usually put it in the big bank because somebody know somebody. You could put it in the credit union and say, use it for community purposes. Or you could put it in a small city bank and say, if you use it for community purposes, we'll put the money in and you can have that for your funding. That's happening all over the country, the use of public money of that kind. It's another piece of this puzzle to finance some of the things we're talking about. In many parts of the country, there is talk of why not set up city banks, city-owned banks. Why not? The taxpayer money is there anyway. If you put it in a bank, I don't know how much you guys know about banking, you multiply what a bank does with your deposit. If you give them a $10,000 in deposit, they get to lend out $90,000. That's how it works. That's how money's created. So and that's how the Federal Reserve Board does it in another way. Most people don't know enough, you know, money is really crazy making, but that's how it works. It is created usually in a multiple size. So a city depositing money in its own bank or in the Bank of North Dakota has that power to really invest large capital in these things and make them grow. Another example, the healthcare system, and this is one to pay attention to. The healthcare system is almost 20% of the U.S. economy, 18% right now. No small change. But think of it as an industry, a fifth of the economy almost. That system is in terrible shape, and it has huge cost problems, and it's going to be throwing people out of the healthcare system when employers say, I don't want to pay for it, and finding ways to get people down and pay the fine instead. The pain levels are already beginning to grow, and the cost level. There is no solution available, in my judgment. There's a whole chapter about this, except the costs and the pain are going to increase. Where the rubber hits the road is in the states. And state by state, many states are beginning to consider one or another form of approach to single-payer health care. Now, what is single-payer? That's public ownership of the basic insurance system. Vermont is on track to do it next year. Connecticut's close. California did it twice and was vetoed by Schwarzenegger. But the pressure that's creating it, that's the thing, the ball to keep your eye on. This is not simply because folks say this is a good idea. We've had a lot of good ideas that politics won't deal with. The pain levels are growing and their solutions are not easily available. And what then can be done, the title of the book, is in fact being done in many states, one by one. And I sometimes use the phrase in the book, in checkerboard fashion. They get some of the states and they're going to do nothing with them, and it's going to go to the right. But that isn't the whole story. The checkerboard has got a lot of other squares on it where people are doing interesting things and building up models. And when their model fails, they may find other models have been developed as a basis of the next political movement of this kind. So we've done some local things, some at the city level, some at the state level. I suppose you noticed that we have just nationalized two of the biggest auto companies in the world and nationalized the biggest insurance company in the world, General Motors, Chrysler, and AIG. Nationalization in the United States? Yep, we just did that. In fact, we still own AIG. When the money began to flow, and when the things, then we gave back General Motors, and we're most of it, and it's going back after the taxpayers paid for it. But those models, major systemic problems, where the system doesn't collapse, but huge systemic risk problems occur, are likely to go on in future. And it is not beyond the possibilities, in my view, of a long developing movement that learns enough on the ground about how you actually do these things, how you actually manage democratically owned institutions, that at some point, some of those institutions, those large ones paid for by the taxpayers, will become significant institutions that may become public utilities. Now that's way down the line, maybe, you know, I'm a historian. 2 to 3 decades is the usual time frame of that. That's how the progressive movement, the populist movement developed. But if you're facing a systemic crisis, and that is the argument of the book, and I think that is the truth, either you build up step by step by step the preconditions of the next transformation, or it doesn't happen. What is interesting is that slowly, step by step, the evidence is more and more things are accumulating, partly out of pain, partly out of young people and older people getting rolling up their sleeves and doing it. The pain will continue unless we do something. And that is beginning to generate what is called the, quote, new economy movement. I don't know if you've heard that term. But a lot of young people and a lot of older people are involved in the spreading group of people trying to do these things with intention. Politics begins when you get to the stage of intention, not simply watching the development unfold, but saying, hey, there's something going on here. If we then began to move as a movement, we could accelerate and build upon what is beginning to happen.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. And now back to the next American Revolution with Gar Opperbitz.
So let me tell you a little story to give you an idea of where this goes over time and how, if you look at a 30-year pattern rather than a picture, snapshot I just gave you, you get a different sense. I was involved in Ohio in 1977 when the first major collapse of the steel industry occurred in Ohio. Some of you in the audience may remember Youngstown Sheet and Tube went down. 5,000 people lost their job on one day in 1977, Black Monday, they called it. 5,000 people in Youngstown meant the community would go down too. And so the steel workers in that town and the city, kind of the ecumenical coalition of the city, the Catholic bishop and the priests and the rabbis, and they all got together and they formed a joint worker ecumenical coalition strategy to put the steel mill back on track. They said, you know, hey, American, very American idea. Why can't we do this? Why can't we put this thing together? 5,000 people, roll up your sleeves, let's do it. I mean, we need to recognize that that is an American cultural idea. We are ahead of most French people don't think that way. We are ahead of a lot of European people in the sense that culture is a very get-up-and-go culture. And it's a big asset. But that was their attitude. There's a sidebar story. One guy, one of the steelworkers named Gerald Dickey, it was his idea. And he said, well, why don't we do that? And so one of the businessmen in the community took him aside and said, you want a steel mill? I can tell you some much better stock to buy than steel mills. That wasn't the name of the game. They wanted to take over the mill. And so they did their organizing, and they did their politics, and they got the churches involved, and they got the community involved, and they got all the local pressure, and they got the press, and they did their work. And they got the Carter administration at that time to finance a $200,000 technical study of how to do it. Now, $200,000 in 1977 was, you know, several million now, or I'm not sure what the number is, but it was a big, big, highly professional study done by the top experts in the steel industry. And they said, X, Y, Z, if you do all that, this mill could be fine. It would certainly be competitive. All you need is $200 million. And then they got the Carter administration to pledge a loan guarantee for $200 million against this professional study under worker community ownership. Incredible achievement. And of course, the money went away after the election of 1978. We don't quite know why the money went away, but probably it went away because you can't prove this, because the big steel corporations went in, and so did the Labor National International Union. The International Steelworkers Union was publicly opposed to the local guys. They didn't want to mess with this, and they also didn't like these upstart activists getting involved because they might challenge the international, and so they cut it to ribbons. We think they went to Washington, but we certainly know they went public against it. So they didn't get their mill, but they knew that the name of the game was not just what we can do today, and they did a huge educational campaign around the state of Ohio, through the national religious groups, wherever they could, student groups. And in the state of Ohio, there are probably more worker-owned companies, maybe more or less than any state in the country, because they did their work to spread the idea. And at Kent State University, they set up a little nonprofit to help people technically. How do you build worker-owned companies out of this experience? So that's a developmental process that went on. 30 years later, in Cleveland, you have the most sophisticated development so far in this movement. So we've gone from worker-owned companies, developing piece by piece. And if you go to Cleveland, here's what you see on the ground in the following neighborhood. And it's really interesting, and it comes out of the developmental trajectory. You want to play this game? Look at it as a developmental problem, not something just going to happen one election. You've got to fight the electoral battles. But we're talking about historical change in terms of institutions and systems. That means throw a couple decades on the table. Well, if you throw decades on the table in Cleveland, out of the Ohio experience, starting with Youngstown, I was one of the guys who helped design the first thing in Youngstown. If you find, you go to Cleveland, you'll find in the following neighborhood, 40,000 people, poor neighborhood in Cleveland, real poor, 40% unemployment, black, $18,000 family income. In the middle of that neighborhood, you will find a sophisticated group of worker-owned companies, which include, for instance, not your little corner co-op, the largest urban hydroponic greenhouse in the United States. By largest, I mean they produce 3 million heads of lettuce a year. You want to get your head around that. To do that, you must plant 26,000 heads of lettuce every single day. So it's a big operation. There is a large-scale industrial laundry worker co-op in a complex, and it's probably the greenest laundry in that part of the country. It uses about a third of the water and a third of the heat, and meets the competition in terms of cost and pays a reasonable wage. That's another one of the worker-owned companies there. And then there's a big solar installation company, which is online to produce something like more installation capacity solar than exists in the entire state. And they are planning to do one or two new every year. So that's the scale of it. But what's really interesting is not only that the idea of worker ownership has gone further and changing who owns the capital by practice in reality, it's got a couple other features. Partly drawn upon the famous Mondragon cooperatives in the Basque country of Spain. For those of you who haven't been following that, 85,000 people in a very sophisticated cooperative structure that's competitive on the world market in many, many markets. But partly drawing on that experience, these worker-owned companies are not just worker-owned companies in it for themselves in Cleveland. They're linked together with a nonprofit corporation. So some of the profits go back to the community, and building it adds to the community possibilities. They're trying to use profits to build the community, not simply to make specific workers rich or wealthy in some sense, though they are advancing themselves. And another part of the profits go into a fund to capitalize, to provide investment capital for other worker-owned companies so you can build new ones. So it is a complex of growing worker-owned companies aimed at rebuilding the community and multiplying in time and linked together with the revolving fund and a nonprofit corporation. So it's a much more sophisticated, integrated model that over time has been developed, even more sophisticated than what I've just said. And by the way, you can do this anyplace. In fact, many, many cities are doing something like the following. Let me add to that what else they've, you know, the developmental path, what they've thought about, and it came right out of this earlier experience as they learned over time. In the middle of this poor, poor community are three major, there are lots of major institutions, but three well-known ones. The Cleveland Clinic, one of the world's leading hospitals, Case Western Reserve University, and university hospitals, big, big institutions. They all have a lot of taxpayer money in them, educational money, Medicaid money, hospital money, Medicare money, and they're sitting there, and unlike big corporations that can come and go, they can't go anywhere. They are so-called anchor institutions. They're anchored. You have them too. Every city's got them. In that poor neighborhood, they buy $3 million in goods and services every single year. I said million? I'm sorry, billion, with a B, not an M. Billion. Leaving aside their salaries, that's separate, that's more. And their construction, that's more. Just what they buy. None of it from the community. Light bulb goes on. Taxpayer money, poor community, worker-owned companies. Why not ask them or request or organize or pressure or force, one way or another, buy from these entities and help develop an entire economy based upon worker ownership and building the community as a whole using this quasi-public money to do that? And that, in fact, is what's happening in Cleveland, Ohio, and in Atlanta, and in many other cities around the country, including Amarillo, Texas, of all places, and many, many other cities. The light bulb has gone on. We aren't dead-ended if we look to different models and begin using what's available and developing the theory, note carefully, that you better transform who gets to own the wealth or the power is going to go back to where it was. So all this is about practical ways to begin democratizing wealth in real terms and an expanding basis in real American communities. Now, enough of the illustrations, and I also don't want to talk too long about this because I want you to read the book. It's much more interesting, I hope, than this talk. But what then must we do, the title of the book, is we can, in fact, build on this. And what people learn from this is, and this is really interesting, I worked in the Cleveland model as well. Our folks have been up there in Cleveland, and part of it's our staff has been involved. The really important thing for people to understand, because they don't understand it, is if you can do it there, we could do it here. And bringing people in who say, hey, this is what we're doing. You guys could do it. And this is how we do it. If you need some help, technically, this is all of a sudden, instead of becoming abstract theory and so forth, it's down home, clearly can be done and ought to be done because other people are doing it. That's how movements get built. You begin to illustrate this. Now, stand back from this. And I won't go on too much longer because you're probably getting tired of this, but let me give you a little broader sense. And remember, I'm a historian as well as a political economist. So I think of things in time dimensions. I think about those guys in Youngstown, Ohio, and the steelworkers, and the 30-year processes that get to more sophisticated, and I think, what can you build on that, if conditions are right? So that's the next part of the argument. It is possible that these many developments and thousands of others that are going on will be sidebar, interesting little experiments, not more. It is possible that the trends that I outline will simply decay. Rome did decay. That's what could happen to the system. It's possible that there'll be violence and repression and fascism or something like that. That's also a logical possibility. When the pain grows, people get crazy and things happen. Probably white violence first, like Oklahoma City bombing and maybe Boston, who knows. That's a logical possibility. I always like to stop here and remind people, because people have a vested interest in pessimism. You know, vested interest, because if nothing can be done, you don't have to do anything. So I just want to remind people, because the fascists, and these are options, logical historical options. If you look to Latin America for the last three decades, you will find repressive fascist regimes. They had them, and they are gone in most countries. So even fascism is not the end of history, maybe, though it can be extremely ugly and painful. I had good friends from Chile. So that's another option.
Coming up next, from the movie Good Night and Good Luck, Edward R. Murrow addresses the Radio Television News Directors Association and Foundation.
This might just do nobody any good. At the end of this discourse, a few people may accuse this reporter of fouling his own comfortable nest, and your organization may be accused of having given hospitality to heretical and even dangerous ideas. But the elaborate structure of networks, advertising agencies, and sponsors will not be shaken or altered. It is my desire, if not my duty, to try to talk to you journeymen with some candor about what is happening to radio and television. And if what I say is responsible, I alone am responsible for the saying of it. Our history will be what we make of it. And if there are any historians about 50 or 100 years from now, and there should be preserved the kinescopes of 1 week of all three networks, they will there find, recorded in black and white and in color, evidence of decadence, escapism, and insulation from the realities of the world in which we live. We are currently wealthy, fat, comfortable, and complacent. We have a built-in allergy to unpleasant or disturbing information. Our mass media reflect this. But unless we get up off our fat surpluses and recognize that television, in the main, is being used to distract, delude, amuse, and insulate us, then television and those who finance it, those who look at it, and those who work at it, may see a totally different picture too late. I began by saying that our history will be what we make it. If we go on as we are, then history will take its revenge and retribution will not limp in catching up with us. Just once in a while, let us exalt the importance of ideas and information. Let us dream to the extent of saying that on a given Sunday night, the time normally occupied by Ed Sullivan is given over to a clinical survey on the state of American education. And a week or two later, the time normally used by Steve Allen is devoted to a thoroughgoing study of American policy in the Middle East. Would the corporate image of their respective sponsors be damaged? Would the shareholders rise up in their wrath and complain? Would anything happen other than a few million people would have received a little illumination on subjects that may well determine the future of this country and therefore the future of the corporations? To those who say people wouldn't look, they wouldn't be interested, they're too complacent, indifferent, and insulated, I can only reply, there is, in one reporter's opinion, considerable evidence against that contention. But even if they are right, what have they got to lose? Because if they are right, and this instrument is good for nothing but to entertain, amuse, and insulate, then the tube is flickering now, and we will soon see that the whole struggle is lost. This instrument can teach, it can illuminate, and yes, it can even inspire. But it can do so only to the extent that humans are determined to use it towards those ends. Otherwise, it is merely wires and lights in a box. Good night, and good luck.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.